and where you're sitting, so where did you take it from here?
Okay, they know where I'm sitting even. I'm pretty impressed. Well, hi everyone, I can't see you of course, which is kind of unfortunate, but that's the way it goes when you're doing this stuff by distance. It's my pleasure to be here, and of course I'm certainly familiar with the e-learning forum and the way you guys are set up and stuff like that, and it's always been something of interest to me. So I've been invited to talk about e-learning 2.0, and I give this talk a couple of days after Jay Cross's post that the term learning 2.0 is useless, forget about it, wipe it out, and all of that, which I find kind of interesting. My slide, if you can move to the next slide, please, after the title. I don't think that we're dealing with just a slogan here. And I want to be a bit cautious when I say that. I was in a meeting with some company this morning. They're saying, oh yeah, we have this supplier. They want to talk about e-learning 2.0. They want to do this. They want to do that. E-learning 2.0. And it was kind of funny to me. And, you know, so the term is going to get mangled out of existence and has already started to be mangled out of existence. But the really important things, I think, that characterize what I've called e-learning 2.0 are not just fads and they're not just slogans. I think they are reflecting a fundamental shift in what's happening online. I've tried to capture that in a couple of points here on this slide. The first, the idea of the movement of the web from a medium, which is to say a type of media that you consume, that you receive, that you read, that you go look at, to the idea of the web as a platform, instead of a place where you consume and even interact with media, it becomes a place where you do things. And I've tried to capture that a little bit in e-learning 2.0, but when I talked about the idea of learning resources as being produced not simply by a resource producer, but by the learners themselves. And that aspect, and that'll come up again a bit later, is reflective of this sort of shift where it's, you know, the stuff that we're working with isn't just stuff that has been given to us, but it's stuff that we create, and we've probably created it in this new web environment. And the other thing, and I won't really have a chance to expand on that a lot, but if we want to talk about it in the questions, in that we can, the shift from the idea of the web as a communication environment to a network. And I know the web has always been a network, and I know that communication isn't going away. But the idea of communication theory is you have an idea in your head, and the whole objective of the enterprise is to take that thing, whatever it is, that concept, that idea, that learning, and somehow transfer it to the other person. The other person's sitting there with their catcher's mitt, and they receive it, and they pop it into their head, and bells ring because communication has happened, and learning can be measured. And it doesn't work that way, and I think we're beginning to understand that better now. Where you in your presence, your online presence, you do what you do. And in my connective knowledge paper, I've talked about demonstrating and modeling rather than telling and arguing. And the other people who are connected to you, they do what they do, and they act and behave in a relatively autonomous fashion. And if there is new knowledge or new information that gets created at their end, it's knowledge or information that gets created by them rather than sent from you to them. And those of you who are involved in pedagogy will recognize the aspects of constructivism to this, in this. And it's not exactly constructivism because it's not necessarily an intentional thing. It's not something you set out to do. It's just something that happens. And so the picture in Web 2.0 is a picture of connected, more or less tightly, autonomous, diverse entities influencing each other, but essentially each doing their own thing. Slide, please. And what that looks like when you begin to roll it out technically, and again, I've just picked a few things here. I've just picked four items, and I could have picked 40 items that characterize this, but when you begin to implement that sort of thing, you get things like structured microcontent. You might ask, well, why structured microcontent? How does that make any sense? But what's happening here is you're having this two-way information exchange. And when you have a two-way information exchange, the importance of protocols such as microcontent, such as RSS and XML, becomes that much more important. Distributed data, the idea that you don't go to a place to get data, and even some of these Web 2.0 companies like Flickr and so on are still kind of in that 1.0 mode because they've set up this place, this environment that you go to. But what happens is that the data comes to you, and it comes to you from all over the place, and it's not in any given place. This whole concept of this institutional repository or this library of knowledge is, on a Web 2.0 point of view, a bit misleading because the data can and should be anywhere. And you take those two concepts and you get the next one fairly naturally. The whole concept of feeds and data integration and APIs, and that's this distributed data interacting back and forth with itself and with the users, and what you get is the network of RSS feeds or the network of OAI repositories. And then underlying that is, because again, all of these things are all over the place, the idea of a single user identity, so that as you go from place to place to place, what holds it together is the person accessing the data rather than in some way the data itself. Slide, please. Drawing a little bit from Macy here, and I'm always reluctant to do that. That's a joke, you can laugh. Although you're probably muted, so you can't hear me. But some characteristics of Web 2.0 velocity. I talked about the idea of content being dynamic a lot. The picture of content, the picture of learning that we should have, rather than of learning and learning resources as being like books on a library shelf, but being much more like a utility, like the water in our taps or the electricity in the wall. The idea of, and drawing on this, the idea of the network that extends to everyone, where you know, anyone who needs to use power, they pretty much can anywhere. You need to plug in your laptop, and you guys probably all went through this. Oh, let's find the PowerPoint, we'll plug it in. Personalization, you know, when you plug in a computer to the wall, you're plugging in your computer, not some generic computer. And the whole idea that as this environment develops, your online presence follows you. Much like today, we carry our laptop around, and that's like our online presence following us. But if you can imagine doing the same thing, except without the laptop. And again, it's this idea of the web not being based on place, not being based on particular services. It's all distributed, and you tap into it, and when you tap into it, the network aligns itself based on your identity and your needs and where you are and what your context is. I know I'm going through some deep grass and very quickly, but yeah, it's a 10-minute talk, so what can you do? So what does this look like? Slide, please. It looks a little bit like the diagram that you see with Led Zeppelin right in the middle, because that's where Led Zeppelin should be, and Bob Dylan nearby. But more to the point, if you picture those as resources or as people or as services, and there isn't a central place. There's a bunch of autonomous things all doing their own thing, but all interconnected with information moving back and forth between them. And on those slides are some links to some more detailed descriptions of what it looks like. Slide, please. Another way of thinking about it is through the perspective of distributed representation. Now, when you look at the diagram there, it's going to look like an entity relationship diagram from a database, right? But think of this database, if you will. I don't like to think of it as a database, but we will for the next few seconds, except it's not in any particular place. And if you imagine a given resource, a book, paper, simulation, whatever, if some information about that resource may be right where it is, where it's stored on the learning website, some information about that resource, such as the author information, might be on a completely different website. Other information on yet further websites, and these bits of information are connected to each other. You know, we have this picture of metadata, of data that describes resources, as though it's like this single document, usually written by the author of the resource. But in a Web 2.0 environment where everything is distributed, even the documents themselves are distributed. And the documents have multiple authors. Think about a document that would describe who you are, what your profile is. And if somebody tried to assemble that, they'd have to go to the police station, or maybe not, hopefully not, but or to the hospital, or to the land titles office, or to the university. They go to all of these places, and they get little bits of information, and they pull it together, and that's what produces a profile. Because you'd never just depend on the person's word for it, right? You need to get this information all over. And that's what the description of resources in general looks like in a Web 2.0 environment, which means that there is no canonical description of a resource. There's no place where you find the metadata. You gather the metadata through an iterative process of harvesting, and you don't gather it all. You gather a perspective or a view of the metadata depending on your own personal interests. And the same sort of approach applies for people, for services, for anything that you can think of. And again, there's just not a single place for it. It's a distributed web where the information flows dynamically. I know I'm data dumping here. I'm really sorry. Slide, please. And where are we? What we know. And this is the example of the person that I just gave you, with what we know about a person and how we know about it, and how when we learn about a person, we're pointing to external information, and as this slide points out, not simply that it's external, that it's dynamic, that it changes on a day-to-day basis. Slide, please. These thoughts brought together in a learning context result overall in what this diagram depicts as the future VLE, and what a lot of the discussion in the field has centered around recently, the personal learning environment, sometimes thought of under the heading of e-portfolios, although there are ways in which that's very misleading. The diagram that you're looking at right there was created by Scott Wilson, and Dave Tosh from ELGG has also created a version of this diagram. And the future of ELE at the center of this is your learning environment. It's your interface to the web. And it's not just the place where you consume, but it's also the place where you create. And then as you can see from the clouds around that, that's the distributed data scattered around the web. And you can see things like 43 Things and Flickr and LearnDirect and LiveJournal. You have blogging engines, photo services, universities, libraries, search engines. And these things, using the protocols that I talked about, interact with your future VLE, and your future VLE interact with them. And the exchange of information goes in two directions, from them to you, from you back out to them. Slide, please. We can characterize this under three major headings. First of all, and very important, a world of learning resources which consists, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, of user-generated content. Now, when I was talking to OECD about open learning resources a couple of weeks ago, what I said to them was, the creation of a learning resource is the beginning of a process. And what happens is the resource goes into the system, and as soon as it goes into the system and starts getting used, it begins to change. And it begins to be used to create new resources. And this is the sort of thing that I mean. These resources, in turn, constitute a vocabulary, a set of words, if you will, that is used to support interactions in a network of users, and hence we get the network of interactions. The idea here is that the interactions aren't just text messages or things like that, but we actually take these resources, reshape these resources, and use these resources to say things to other people. In the way that you might make a political point with a video, for example, except you might not always be talking politics. And then we see some of the technology that underlies those two things. And I've talked a lot about the use of blogs in learning, and a blog is a classic example of user-generated content, and when you add RSS to that, it's user-generated content which exists in a network of interactions. And then once you've got the RSS and the Atom and all of that, then you get these other services that begin doing the job of aggregating it, organizing it, filtering it, redistributing it, and the like. Slide, please. From the perspective of educators, we get new roles. Robin Good has popularized the concept of the newsmaster. The idea that the role here is to look at this flow of information and be able to recognize and filter patterns and emergent phenomena in this information in order to create new knowledge. There's the roles of localization, finding things that are relevant for a particular group of readers or people who are on this network. Personalization, highlighting what's relevant. A lot of the work that I've done over the last 2 years, especially in e-learning, has been just this kind of work, where I'm drawing things together and identifying the context in which they're important and then sending them out. Slide, please. We're seeing a lot of this come up in some of the new types of technology and the new things that have come online in the last 2 years. Podcasting, I guess everybody knows about podcasting now. That was just a glint in someone's eye a couple of years ago. Flickr with photographs, Wikipedia, which everybody talks about in this context. I mentioned Rice, and I want to mention as well the connections service at Rice, which is a mechanism whereby people can go in and create their own learning resources and more. Slide, please. The idea of content syndication is something that I linger on a lot when I talk about eLearning 2.0, because I consider it backbone to this. I think without something like syndication, it doesn't work. And a lot of people talk a lot of the time about federated networks and private networks and all of that. My own view is that the mechanisms for the exchange of information need to be as diverse and individual as the sources of the information as well. In other words, there shouldn't be just one network in the sense that for any given piece of information, there ought to be multiple potential aggregators. And for any person who's interacting with the network, there ought to be multiple points by which they interact. And we see this in the blog community, where if you want to get the list of top bloggers, for example, you can pick TechNerdy, or you can pick PubSub, or you can pick Feedster and the like, and you get a very different picture. And this is a necessary thing, because there is no single way of looking at this massive resources. It's really going to depend on how you aggregate and how you filter. Slide, please. On this picture, learning becomes a network phenomenon, and George Siemens has popularized the term connectivism to try to capture that, and I've tried to talk a bit about that, how that works epistemologically in my connective knowledge paper. But basically what you get is an overall web of user-generated content, and that content is used as an information medium inside social networks and online communities and the like by people who have identities. And these people bring in this content, remix it, repurpose it, aggregate it, and then most importantly, feed it forward. And the locus of this learning is in a personal learning center, a personal learning environment. And just as an aside, I don't want you to think of that as an application. If you sit down and try to build a personal learning environment as an application, then that's not the right concept. And you need to think of the personal learning environment, if you will, I'm being fuzzy here, as a presence, as a way that you are present on the internet. But it might not be any given application. It might be a whole set of applications, or it might just be the room recognizing that, oh, Stephen Downs is in the room, and readjusting itself and becoming the personal learning environment for now for Stephen. Slide, please. What makes this work, and for me this is the checklist of what distinguishes between technologies or approaches that I like and ones that I don't like. First of all, things that are diverse work much better than things that are not diverse. If you have multiple technologies, multiple approaches, multiple points of view. Secondly, and as the slogan goes, small pieces loosely joined. It's not a tightly closed, integrated system. It's rather a network of autonomous components. And in order for any of this stuff to happen at all, the network has to be open. Any barrier to the transfer of information, any barrier to the repurposing or recreation of information is something that puts a drag on it. It puts up fences, it's like an anchor. So those three things are the major things that I use when I'm looking at some approach or technology and asking, is this an e-learning 2.0 type technology? Last slide, and that's basically what I have to say in what I hope was a bit less than 10 minutes. And I'm ready for comments or questions. It probably wasn't 10 minutes. But
thank you very much, Stephen. Clearly, there's so much going on. There's so many different technologies. It's opening up so many opportunities and possibilities here that's what I think a number of people I talk to are a little concerned about. They, you know, how do you deal with this, particularly in the corporate environment? It feels like a chaotic world, and it's getting more tools, more information, more things you could do. Now, it's wonderful for the learner, but I assume that it becomes an increasingly difficult challenge, particularly for those who find themselves in a more traditional training function. So what are some of the reactions that you have seen since you wrote your initial article, and as there's been an ongoing discussion of these things in recent months? Maybe you could give us some of the impressions of some of the things you've heard.
Yeah, well, the primary reaction has been just that, the one you just gave me. The idea that this is all out of control and how can you manage it? And there are various iterations of that reaction, the most prominent of which is, well, how can you be sure that the learning will be of high quality? And in fact, I had that discussion just this morning, so I got that reaction yet again. And I don't know what it is. There's this irresistible urge on the part of people to try to manage the process. And my observation and my belief is that the results of managing the process are actually worse than the results if you don't manage the process. And I know that feels counterintuitive, But the example that was given this morning, and I'm not betraying any confidences here, what I was saying is, you know, you have somebody, they're looking at the manual, they want to repair a piece of equipment, and the way this system works is that they record their interactions with the manual and the piece of equipment. They report what happened, right? And then that becomes a new piece of learning, a new piece of knowledge, and gets fed back into the system. And the comment came up, well, what if the report is wrong? What if the person, for example, reported that the manual was just completely wrong, but they made that report because they pressed the wrong key 7 times in a row? And, okay, here we have an example of very clearly false data entering the system, and nobody would dispute that it's false. But the first thing is, the first question I asked was, what kind of management could possibly prevent that error? There's no way to filter for those kind of mistakes. And indeed, if you look at the stuff that is managed, look at Encyclopedia Britannica, for example, we find mistakes there. And this is a general case. And so there's no way to prevent the error, but now we're laboring under the false presumption that the information that we have is accurate. But the second thing is, if you keep the content network open, if you allow this information to go in without trying to manage it, filter it, and control it, the very next person who picks up this new learning resource with the 7 incorrectly pressed buttons, they will see that, oh, the previous person was wrong. The manual was actually right, and I don't know what they did, but they did something stupid, and they put that into the system, and now the error has been corrected. And nobody has gone out to try to prevent bad information or to correct information, but it's in this process of use and recirculation that the information does get corrected. And so that's my response. And people come back, well, but some businesses don't want to change. Some businesses, they just want, you know, the standard e-learning. And my answer to them was, if I'm a provider, if I'm offering e-learning services, and I'm tooling up and investing and hiring in order to offer e-learning services, I am not going to invest time in that company because they're a bad risk. And I'm going to tell that company that. And the approach here is, I'm not going to argue with them or explain or things like that, because you can't, right? I can see her, I can talk all day and try to explain things to you guys. If you don't believe me, you don't believe me. But I will say, I will not invest my time and resources in a bad model. And I think that's the only way to go. I think we can't be pushed by the economic imperative into doing things that we don't work, because that just simply perpetuates things that don't work. And so that's the attitude that I take, and I think that we have to take. And I don't know if that's a direct enough answer to your question, but that's the best one I've got.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen. Let's take a few questions here. I'm sure there must be some questions. So who has some? No? They're pensive. They're stunned by this, Stephen. They, you know, some of this stuff clearly has sink in, but here we have one. Hold on for one second.
And I missed the first part of the question. How does accountability and liability form into this? If the instructions are wrong, and you know somebody's like a business is liable, maybe if it's a spelling, you know how to spell a word, and it's wrong, there's no liability. But if that machine blows up, then somebody's liable. From your previous example.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's a reasonable question. Of course, the presumption is that the manual is always right, and it isn't. But look, liability is based on, you have taken the best path possible in order to minimize error. Because we recognize that error is going to happen. Right, and you know, there are going to be things that happen for which you are not liable. Because we all know that we don't live in a perfect world. you know, I mean, and the standard of the law is, you know, did you take proper care, reasonable precautions, things like that. The standard isn't, did nothing go wrong? The standard is, did you do everything that you could have in order to prevent something from going wrong? So, okay, now we have two approaches. One approach is the filtered, managed, controlled information approach with the definitive intent to minimize error. And the other approach is the more open, user-generated content Web 2.0 approach. And you put those two approaches side by side and you compare them. And here's the empirical test. I argue, and I believe I can show, that the open approach will produce fewer errors. That's an empirical thing. This happens, you know, people need to go out and study this and actually prove it now, right? Instead of taking my word for it, because who would? But now let's assume that that has been proven. And now you go back before the judge and somebody wants to hold you liable for, you know, using this open process, and your defense now is something like, well, judge, there were two approaches. We used the one that we know empirically reduces the number of errors. Now, in this particular case, an error was caused by information that happened to be false. But that's a property of the system. And to hold us liable, what you are doing is saying, in essence, that it is necessary for us to use a less reliable system in order to prevent ourselves from being held to account for liabilities. And I think that that's a sufficient argument. I think that if you can show that the process that you're following is in general more reliable than the other process, then the specific instances of that process that fail will not result in you being held liable.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Do we have one more, or is it time for a break here? People have been sitting for quite a long time here, so I don't see any more questions. So thank you very much, Stephen. We really appreciate your contribution, and you have given us a lot to think about here, and I think also people will probably reflect a little more. You know, we'll post your presentation on the e-learning website, and so people can access it and think about some of these things and go out and test and look at some of these tools and some of the things that are out there. So, again, thank you very much, Stephen.
Thanks a lot, everyone. Thanks for inviting me. I'm sorry it was like a quick drop-in data dump, but do drop by my website, and of course I'm always available by email. So I really appreciate the chance to talk to all of you, and I hope you have yourselves a pleasant morning, and a warmer one than it is here.
Thank you, Stephen. We'll hopefully see you in Innsbruck this summer.
Okay, then. Talk to you later.
Take care.